Perhaps it's difficult for us to connect with what's happening in our gospel today, even though we're familiar with the story. Think of the occasional parade welcoming a champion sports team back to their hometown. In Green Bay, I know this is either a distant memory or something that looks very far in the future these days, so use your imagination. Nowadays, this is the only time, really, that we can picture ourselves in a crowd eagerly watching the entry of someone with such celebration. We've all seen old photographs of ticker tape parades in New York or triumphant heroes entering into a town of one or another. Can you imagine feeling so much hope and joy at the entrance into your city or town of someone who represents not political, not military, not sports victory, but the coming of peace itself? As it happens, if you were listening to this story almost 2,000 years ago when it was written, and of course you lived somewhere in the Eastern Mediterranean ancient world, you would hear something more. It would sound familiar to you, very much like the ominous entrance into your city of a military conqueror escorted by his troops. In their wonderful book, The Last Week, Marcus Borg and John Dominic Crossan begin their account of Jesus' last 7 days with a colorful description of this procession by the King of Peace into one end of Jerusalem, at the same time that the Roman Emperor's representative, Pontius Pilate, full of brute power, enters from the other end. Picture this. Pilate has arrived to keep the peace in the city during the turbulent time of Passover, the Jewish celebration of freedom, when the crowds always got a little unruly. He travels with troops and flags and weapons, all signs of the empire. Very impressive, of course. And he rides in, as John said, on a magnificent war horse, in case the flags and the weapons and the troops weren't sufficiently intimidating display of power. On the other hand, Jesus, filled with a very different kind of power, makes his entrance riding a humble donkey, surrounded by his somewhat ragtag group of followers, and we know that he doesn't keep the same kind of peace that Pilate and Rome intended to impose. A business as usual kind of peace that benefits the empire and the folks on top. No, Jesus brings instead the peace that surpasses all understanding. And much of what is about to unfold in the next days will be the price that he pays for bringing that peace. His disciples, of course, have seen things that have changed their lives forever, and their hopes have been raised sky high. Maybe they're not quite sure yet what to hope for when their leader rides, of all things, a donkey, a humble work animal rather than a grand war horse. What sort of a sign, what sort of a signal does this send? What sort of statement is Jesus making? Of course, this particular donkey, like any animal suitable for sacred use, has never been ridden. And that should tell them something. Something sacred is happening right before their very eyes. Yes, a common donkey might not be the sort of animal that one rides into war, into conquest, but this is no triumphant warrior or conquering power coming into the city or even into our hearts. This is the King of true peace. these disciples are, as usual, clueless. They don't know what's about to happen in the next few days. Today, they're just full of joy and expectation. Evidently, they haven't been listening any of the times that Jesus has said that he must suffer and die, but that he would rise again. But the Pharisees, like many religious leaders in all times, are worried. They seem to have better instincts than most folks about these things, and they can sense that there's trouble brewing. They know about Pilate coming in the other gate of the city, and they're not ignorant of what can happen if Rome feels threatened by a ragtag group of religious enthusiasts. Rome steps on people brutally and puts them in their place. So the Pharisees fret. "Teacher," they say, "tell your followers to hush. They're going to bring down the heel of Rome on all of our throats. Don't go causing trouble right now." Alas, we Christians, we followers of Jesus, have not done such an excellent job of getting his message of compassion and love. Instead, for 2,000 years, we've often been part of the same brute power systems that stepped on those people of Jerusalem so long ago. For centuries, when we got the upper hand, we participated in a whole array of horrors, from the Inquisition to religious wars, from witch burnings to the repression of women to selling of slaves, from colonial empires to the killing of the Jews. And we used a misreading of the Bible in every case to justify what we did, in the name of the God of love. And all of this time, the God of compassion, I have to imagine, must have wept. And so as we step into this holiest of weeks, I've invited church members to read reflective poems about what happened on each day of Jesus' last week. Reflections that hopefully draw you into this most profound time. My hope in doing so is that by immersing ourselves, we may find our current context in these stories. Are you the prophet upending tables and transforming systems? Are you the innocent, falsely accused, or the beloved friend abandoned when the chips are down? Are you the one quietly walking away because the stakes are just too high? Wherever you are, my invitation is to linger. Linger in the stories of Jesus' passion this week. Join us for supper on Thursday, for song and scripture and light and darkness on Friday. And in doing so, prepare yourself for God's greatest promise, that of new life in love.
It was on the Sunday that Jesus took on the city. Religious nuts usually appear in the desert, urging people to come into the open air and find God through getting back to nature. God, the idea is, doesn't live in the city. God prefers the smell of a garden to that of a gutter. God likes to see children playing beside streams, not hanging out on the sidewalk. And far better in God's eyes are lovers lounging in the long grass rather than shacking up in a single bed. The city is for sin, and God doesn't go there. The Lord is my shepherd, not my social worker. He makes me to lie down in green pastures. not on shrinks' couches. He leads me beside still waters, not trickles of urine from a beggar's bladder. And the peace messenger's feet are beautiful on the mountains, not in the middle of a conference room. But Jesus knew that God was for the people. So he took his message of justice and peace to where the people were. It was on the Sunday that Jesus took on the city.
It was on Monday that religion got in the way and Jesus turned the tables. An outsider would have thought it was a fire sale at a pet shop, and that outsider, in some ways, wouldn't have been far from wrong. Only it wasn't household pets. It was pigeons that were being purchased. And it wasn't a fire sale. It was a rip-off stall in a holy temple, bartering birds for sacrifice, and the price was something only the rich could afford. No discount to students, to pensioners, to Social Security claimants. Then he, the holiest man on earth, went through this bizarre, well, like a bull in a china shop. So the doves got liberated and the pigeon sellers got angry. The poor people clapped like mad and the police went crazy. All because he was making a spectacle that God was for everybody, and not just for those who could afford it. He turned the tables on Monday, the day religion got in the way.
It was on the Tuesday that Jesus let them have it. If you had been there, you would have thought that a union official was being taken to task by a group of mobsters, or that the chairman of a multinational corporation was being interrogated by left-wing activists posing as shareholders. They wanted to know why, and they wanted to know how. They were the respectable men, the influential men, the establishment. The questions they asked ranged from silly schoolgirl speculations about whether you would be a bigamist in heaven if you had married twice on earth, to what was the central rule of civilized behavior. They knew the answers already, or so they thought. Otherwise, they never would have asked the questions. And like so many of us, they were looking for an argument with no intention of a change of heart. So he filleted them with his tongue, those who tried to look interested but never wanted to be committed. That was on the Tuesday, the day when he let them, let us, have it.
It was on the Wednesday that they called him a wasteful person. The house smelled like the perfume counter at a department store. It was as if somebody had bumped an elbow against a bottle and sent it crashing to the floor, setting off the most expensive stink bomb on earth. But it happened in a house, not a shop. And the woman who broke the bottle was no casual afternoon shopper. She was the poorest of the poor, giving away the only precious thing she had. And he sat still while she poured the liquid all over his head, as unnecessary as aftershave on a full crop of hair and a bearded chin. And those who smelled it, and those who saw it, and those who remembered that he was against extravagance, called him a wasteful person. They forgot that he was also the poorest of the poor. And they who had much and who had given him nothing objected to a pauper giving him everything. Jealousy was in the air when a poor woman's generosity became an embarrassment to their tight-fistedness. That was on the Wednesday when they called him a wasteful person.
It was on Thursday that he gave himself. Nothing less, and so much more. He offered grace without blemish as they left behind the years of loneliness, grief, and estrangement, promising to follow him into an unknown future. It was night when salvation drew near. He knelt to serve us, trying to ready us for all that would happen, all that it will mean to follow him. In humility, he washed their feet so they might follow him down the dusty road to death. In love, he transformed a simple meal into a feast of unfathomable grace. It was on Thursday that he drew us near to one another and to himself, becoming God's most intimate covenant with us. A covenant to become as intimately a part of us as the food we eat and the cup we drink.
It was on the Friday that they ended it all. Of course, they didn't do it one by one. They weren't brave enough. They would have to throw all the stones at the one time or throw no stones at all. They did it in crowds where you can feel safe and lose yourself and shout things you would never shout on your own and do things you would never do if you felt the camera was watching you. It was a crowd in a church that did it, and a crowd at a game that did it, and a crowd in a street that did it, and a crowd on the hill that did it. And he said nothing. He took the insults, the bruises, the spit on the face, the thongs on the back, the curses in the ears. He took the sight of his friends turning away, running away, and he said nothing. He let them do their worst until their worst was done, as on Friday they ended it all, and would have ultimately ended it for themselves had he not cried, "Father, forgive them," and began the revolution.
It was on the Saturday that the world stood still. There was deep rest around the grave of Jesus. On the seventh day, when the work of creation was completed, God rested. God blessed the seventh day and made it holy, because on that day, God rested after God's work of creating. On the seventh day of the week of redemption, when Jesus had fulfilled all that he had been sent by the Father to do, he rested in the tomb. And the women whose hearts were broken with grief rested with him. Of all the days in history, Holy Saturday, the Saturday during which the body of Jesus lay in the tomb in silence and darkness behind the large stone which was rolled against its entrance, is the day of God's solitude. It's the day on which the whole creation waits in inner darkness. It is the day when no words are spoken, no proclamations made. The Word of God, through whom all had been made, lay buried in the darkness of the earth. This Holy Saturday is the most quiet of all days. Its quiet connects the first not yet knowing world, the temple, to the new worship in the Spirit. The sacrifices of blood with the sacrifices of bread and wine. The law with the gospel. This divine silence is the most fruitful silence that the world has ever known. For from this silence, the word will be spoken again and make all things new. It was on Saturday that the world stood still.